From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. One of the reasons we all like to talk about music so much is that we all listen to it differently. No one has exactly the same taste in music as you, so there's always something to discover or to turn a friend onto or to argue about. Kind of like sports, you know? Being a Yankee fan just wouldn't be so much fun without Red Sox fans to hate on. So, in the spirit of discovering and turning your friends on and arguing about music, we're going to speak with author Nathan Rabin about the fans of two music groups that might have image problems. The Fishheads, who follow the jam band Fish, and the Juggalos, who follow the horror-themed hip-hop duo Insane Clown Posse. His book is called You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me. So there. Also, Soundcheck producer Greta Cohn is going to turn us on to an L.A. folk rock band she likes, called Dawes. They'll play us a few songs. Let's start, though, by talking about where our musical tastes really began, when we first shelled out our own money to buy that first album, that first single. We've been hearing from a lot of you this week, and Judah from New York told us about his first album.
First album I bought was Cosmos Factory in September 1970. I was a paper boy, and they gave you discount albums if you sold subscriptions. Dreams Clearwater was incredibly hot then, and an amazing surprise, they had a great long version of Heard It Through the Grapevine, which was fantastic.
Ooh, I heard it through the grapevine. Not much longer would you be mine.
One of my paper deliveries was to Billy Crystal in Long Beach. And I've seen him in his underwear. Thank you.
No, Judah, thank you for an image that I will now spend the rest of the night trying to erase from my brain. We'll hear some more of your first album stories later, but let's talk about where you might go today if you were buying that all-important first album. In the background, you're hearing the song John S. by Sonny Rollins. Now, if you're interested in picking it up on vinyl, you don't have to go on a record store treasure hunt or dig through bins in a garage sale. You can find it at Urban Outfitters. Yes, the hip and often pricey clothing chain. Writer Chris Chafin is here with me in the studio. He wrote the Village Voice article called Is It Okay to Buy Records at Urban Outfitters? Chris, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
Is it okay to buy records at Urban Outfitters?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you ask, and it depends on what you mean,
why
I guess, by okay.
Why is this even a question, first of all?
Well, you know, because we're saddled with decades of, like, punk attitudes about, you know, I mean, I've seen movies from the 90s about great independent record stores and about how evil corporations are and, like, big record executives chomping cigars. And, you know, a lot of that carries over into today, even though the music landscape is so different now mm-hmm. than it was in the 80s, say.
So, I mean, were you surprised to find that at Urban Outfitters you could find not only music but some pretty decent music?
I was very surprised. Like, I thought, like I say in the article, it would be basically the record version of a college dorm room poster sale. Like, just the Doors, just, like, Britney Spears for, like, kitsch value, and then that would be it, and on to, like, Hamburger Phones. But there was a lot of stuff, you know, everything from Queen's soundtrack for Flash Gordon to Sonny Rollins to Dinosaur Jr. to new stuff like Dum Dum Girls.
On vinyl.
On vinyl, yeah. And, you know, I started flipping and I thought it would be very quick, but there's just bins and bins and bins. And it's, you know, it was actually pretty fun to look through, and I think my lunch was cold by the time I got back.
And they have every Dinosaur Jr. record?
I mean, I don't want to say every single one, but let me say I saw at least four or five of them.
All right.
Which, isn't that all of them? Are there more than I'm...
No. That sounds like a pretty... I mean, yeah. There are always completists who will say, well, of course, there's the limited edition B-side. But if you're a fan of Dinosaur Jr. and want to hear Repulsion on vinyl, who knew? Urban Outfitters is a place where you can find it.
I feel your eyes upon me. How should I activate to feel so unsure always? Give up on now, keep on this way. The silence taps my elbow. It's good, at least that's what she said. I could run, but I stand and greet it. Boredom won't stop as long as I feed it.
That is Repulsion from the band Dinosaur Jr. on vinyl, available in some stores, including Urban Outfitters, as detailed in Chris Chafin's article for The Village Voice called Is It Okay to Buy Records at Urban Outfitters? One thing I take away, Chris, from your article is that there is vinyl to be had at Urban Outfitters, and that I take that as a good sign for that part of the industry, at least.
Yeah, there is vinyl, and it is a very good sign for the industry. I mean, I spoke with people at labels like Sub Pop and some distributors, and they said, look, the retail landscape now is pretty decimated, and if you're talking about record retail, you're basically talking about Best Buy and Walmart, mm-hmm. You know, so they're happy to work with someone like Urban Outfitters.
Well, now, to joining us to give us a little bit of perspective from the record industry, the vinyl side, is Thomas Burnich. He's the owner of Brooklyn Phono, a vinyl production facility in Brooklyn in the Sunset Park neighborhood. Thomas, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So do you know where these LPs go once you've pressed them? I mean, have you ever seen something you've pressed at a place like Urban Outfitters?
Actually, I haven't checked Urban Outfitters, but I've seen labels that I've pressed in Urban Outfitters. But major labels use multiple pressing plants, so I'm probably in Urban Outfitters, but I'm not positive. I haven't double-checked.
Well, I mean, you know, the title of Chris's article, Is It Okay to Buy Records at Urban Outfitters, as someone who's in the business of making vinyl records, I would assume your answer to that would be a resounding yes.
It's good, right, the medium is the message, and so seeing it in Urban Outfitters feels good down the line that we're not going to evaporate tomorrow as an industry. And in the same breath, I see it going to little places all over, so I know it's okay, you know, and I also hear Dinosaur Jr. now, and this is something that I didn't hear everywhere, you know, ages ago. So, you know, it has the evolution, mm-hmm. and so I see the little things eventually evolving, and customers like that.
Has there been, and I'll throw this question out to you too, Chris, has there been a kind of resurgence of interest in music as something physical, something tangible that you can hold and read liner notes and check out, you know, and yes, get up halfway through to flip the record over, you know, in an age when music has become so kind of up in the cloud. Have you guys seen a resurgence of this sort of thing?
I mean, I have definitely. You know, the estimates are anything from like 5 to 25 million records get sold every year. And I know just like going to shows in Brooklyn, I mean, the merch bands have is T-shirts, tote bags, and records. And maybe cassettes sometimes these days because those are back also. Actually, Urban Outfitters just started selling cassettes too.
Please, please let's not go back to 8-track tapes, though.
Just give it enough time.
Thomas? Have you had the same experience?
Yes. My colleague has said get more equipment as soon as you can. And, you know, he's planning for the future and doubling up. And I can see other colleagues have added shifts. So instead of working just 8 hours, they're working 16 or actually looping it around all 24.
Wow.
And there's other great stuff like in Brooklyn here, they have the record fair twice a year, I guess, where in Williamsburg they take a whole big parking lot, fill it with all the record labels that are based here. And, you know, the place is packed all day long with people buying new records and used records. And, I mean, it's a great thing to see.
Has the manufacturing process, Thomas, has it changed materially since, say, the 1970s, the heyday of the LP? Not that you're old enough to have...
It's the same equipment. So yeah. When I open my control panel, I can see 1978 sticker, Capitol Records. It's you know, nothing has changed. And then compound or the plastics have... The technology has improved for formulas and such, but its ingredients have changed. So you would save a little money by using a different.
I just have to ask, Thomas. Yeah. How did you get into this? Why start Brooklyn Phono at a time when the industry really was in peril?
I visited a company with a buddy picking up a project. They used to be either in this building or next door, and they had moved to Long Island City, and they were a brand new installation. So it was an old record company that reinstalled themselves right off the Queensboro Bridge. The company was called Europa Disc, so I don't know. We could figure out were they in this or the next building. And it was beautiful. And I thought, oh, record pressing is beautiful. Brand new installation, everything's beautiful. And I had no idea it's rough. You know, I didn't see the boiler. I didn't see the cooling towers. I didn't see the masses of material.
So you saw the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood version of record pressing.
And I stepped on it, and the next thing I knew, it was on my shoulder, on top of my head, you know, on the back of my hand. It was everywhere. And I got myself...
It being what? Like melted, you
know,
vinyl?
Yeah, or? Like, you know, you step on bubble. you know when you get, like, ochre paint or something, you're painting, you get a little bit of ochre somewhere, and the next thing you know, like, you see it everywhere. And so that was, you know, it's one of those special things that, like, you can't go near it without it... getting all over everything.
Well, I'm glad you're fighting the good fight and not me, because that sounds pretty messy.
Yeah.
Thomas Bernich is owner of Brooklyn Phono, a full-service vinyl production facility in Sunset Park in Brooklyn. And Chris Chafin, also here with me, is the author of the Village Voice article, Is It Okay to Buy Records at Urban Outfitters? And Chris, I mean, we talked briefly before about, you know, this being a good sign for the industry. I would guess that in answer to the question
titular,
of your title, yeah. Virtually every label would also kill to get into a place, any place, but Urban Outfitters, you know, especially.
Yeah, definitely. The people I spoke with at Sub Pop said they were so happy not just to be put in front of that audience, which is, you know, mostly college kids, but Urban works with them on all sorts of stuff, like making temporary tattoos that say Sub Pop, putting up big window displays for them. And for a label like that, which, you know, has a big name, but a lot of their great releases are maybe a little bit in the past, like early Nirvana, stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
They're thrilled to get in front of that audience. And, you know, other people I spoke with say, look, nobody buys one record. You know, if you're going to buy a record and a record player, you know, you're hooked. The next time you see records, you're like, oh, I'll pick up one of those. I have a record player. And your friends are like, oh, you have a record player? And then, you know, you get another one and another one.
But see, that doesn't happen anymore, that people go, oh, you have a record player? Because it seems to have become like a cool thing.
I'll tell you who still says that to me is older people. Like, you know, I live in Bed-Stuy. Somebody I was talking to in my building, I'd come home with a record and they said, what are you going to do with that record? I have a record player. And they're like, no, you don't. You don't have a record player.
Thomas, did you have a record player before you became a record plant?
Yeah. I had an old B&O, and I loved it.
A Bang & Olufsen.
Yeah. An old, like,
okay.
I got
the
a real
good
kick
stuff.
Out of that.
Yeah, it's
well,
fancy.
It was the low version, so I got a real kick out of having something. It was a little fancy, but not spectacular.
So what do we take away from this? Is vinyl back for good? It's a small part of the overall market, but is it on an upswing? Is it here for good? Or is it just like a little bubble that'll pop and go away?
It's the fastest growing part of music sales, which is, I mean, it's still small. It's under 10%. But, you know, the trend has been upward for this whole decade, while the trend in the rest of the industry has been sharply down, like, what, 50% or more in overall album sales. So, I mean, I think it's a small part of the industry that's growing, and it's going to be around for a long time.
Good news for you, Thomas, and your colleagues.
Thank you.
Thomas Bernich is owner of Brooklyn Phono in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. Chris Chafin, the writer whose Village Voice article occasioned this portion of Soundcheck, is called Is It Okay to Buy Records at Urban Outfitters? I think we've come to the conclusion it is seriously okay. Guys, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you,
John.
I never said.
This summer marks 20 years since the release of this classic indie rock album, Exile in Guyville, by the singer-songwriter Liz Phair, and a bunch of other remarkable albums from PJ Harvey, The Roots, Nirvana, Diggable Planets, Björk, and more. All next week, we're going to look back at those albums and others as part of a series called Summer of 93. But we need your help. In 30 seconds or less, we want to know, where were you in the summer of 93, and what were you listening to? Leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Try to keep it to 30 seconds. We might play your story on the air. That's 866-939-1612. Coming up, find out what happens when I go on vacation. The producers start doing the interviews. Our own Greta Cohn welcomes the alt-folk band Dawes to the studio, and we'll hear Dawes play songs from a new album called Stories Don't End. That's next on Soundcheck.
Have you ever thought your little girl glamour shot and the events of that whole day spent at the mall is maybe a part of you?
This is Soundcheck. I'm producer Greta Cohn. The band Dawes is in our New York studio today, all the way from Los Angeles. Dawes is a group that is no stranger to the road. Their travels have taken them from the rolling hills of California all the way to Rwanda. Along the way, they've shared the stage with acts like Jackson Browne, Bob Dylan, and Alison Krauss. Their latest album is called Stories Don't End, and we'll hear more about it in a moment. But first, let's hear a song all about their travels. It's called From a Window Seat. Here's Dawes, live on Soundcheck.
One, two. Seatbelt and plug my headset in a chair, and to the music I watch flight attendants move. They are pointing at the exits, but it looks more like a prayer, or an ancient dance their bloodline reaches through. These planes are good for sifting through the warriors from the men. I get time to sit and watch them for a while. You could see everywhere they're going and everywhere they've been, and how they look out at the clouds each time they smile. And I think maybe he's in town for someone's birthday, or maybe he makes trouble everywhere. But as much as he resists the conversation between the rivers and the freeways, he knows it's always there. As the Northwest Passage sits somewhere below me as I sleep, I dream of captains and explorers eating boots. When I ask if I can join them, and they offer one to me, I wake up as my home comes into view. So I reach down for my notebook to see what impressions could be spun, but it's just buildings and a million swimming pools. So I leaf back through the pages to see where I am from, or for some crumbled map of what it's leading to. And I find that the hero in the song that I am writing doesn't know he's just an image of myself. But as much as he resists the conversation between the rivers and the freeways, he's somehow always asking them for help.
why the trees reach for the sky, or in the length of someone's hair. 'Cause when you don't know where you are going, any road will take you there. So maybe I'm in town for someone's birthday, or maybe I make trouble everywhere. But as much as I resist the conversation between the rivers and the freeways, I know it's always there. I know it's always there. I know it's always there.
That's the band Dawes live on Soundcheck with a song From a Window Seat from their new album, Stories Don't End. I'm joined here in the studio by 3/4 of Dawes in a kind of a stripped down setup. We have Tay Strathairn on piano and vocals, Griffin Goldsmith on vocals, Taylor Goldsmith on guitar and vocals, Wiley Gelber, not here today, usually playing bass, but Taylor, to you and the guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
From a Window Seat, I mean, this song is all about looking at the world from like 30,000 miles away. Is that, do you draw inspiration from travels? Is that something that you are intent on doing, is sort of pulling back out and looking from that broader perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, something that I'll click into. It's not like, okay, now why don't I'm sitting here on this plane, why don't I put my songwriter cap on and start thinking about it in that sense. It's more just, yeah, I mean, the first verse is very much what happened, where these absurdities, or at least they, at that point they were striking me as absurdities, of literally taking a headset and plugging it into a chair and watching these flight attendants flail their arms around. And it becomes a funny experience thinking what us humans accept as a normal day-to-day routine.
When you're traveling all the time, is that the time when you do your writing? I mean,
yeah, I mean, sometimes it can be hard to carve out time to explore a song idea, because, you know, we're around each other a lot, and it's great. And, you know, things like Soundcheck will really serve as a great opportunity to explore a new idea. But for me, a big part of songwriting comes from trial and error, and following through ideas that I eventually don't really stand behind or think are any good. And so to do that is, you know, can be tough enough, but then to do that in front of people it sounds like a real nightmare. So I mean, I don't really write as much on tour as I'd like, because we're just always kind of in each other's presence. So yeah, it's times like that where like on a plane or something like that, where I can quietly kind of see what I could put together on some level.
Yeah. This is Soundcheck. I'm producer Greta Cohn in for John Schaefer, and we're talking with the band Dawes. For those of you listening, it's D-A-W-E-S, Dawes. Where does the name come from?
Griffin's and my grandfather is named was named Dawes Lafayette Goldsmith. And a lot of the music he would play for us when we were young and when he was alive, it didn't resonate with us, and we didn't really...
Like what? What was that?
Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and Hank Williams and stuff that later, maybe in a more peripheral sense, was influencing our, like, the music we were making as Dawes. But when he was originally showing it to us, it wasn't reaching us. We were little kids, and it was our grandpa playing us his favorite records. So it was like a little bit just like, okay, thanks, yeah. And then when the time came where we realized how heavy that stuff was and how incredible that stuff was, he was gone. So it was kind of our way of including him in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a tribute. Mm-hmm. In the band name. That's great. Well, let's hear another song. The band Dawes is with us in this studio today. They're playing on Wednesday, July 24th at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York. But they're playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. And the next song they're going to play for us is called Most People.
if she listens very carefully to a room of conversation, she can feel the planet orbiting through space. She hears pieces of arguments, beginnings of jokes, and the odd lines of a song she cannot place. And it all makes up an image that resists interpretation, which is lately how she likes to see herself. How she does not believe in accidents, doesn't disagree out loud, and falls in love with every man she cannot help. And she thinks most people don't talk enough about how lucky they are. Most people don't know what it takes for me to get through the day. Most people don't talk enough about the love in their hearts. But she doesn't know most people feel that same way. If she focuses her energies on just walking through the neighborhood with depths and shallows nobody could sound, like January Christmas lights under billion-year-old stars, she comes up with more of what is lost than what is found. So by the time that she explains to me just a glimpse of what she's understood, she betrays the meaning, putting it in words. So she smiles at me lovingly and says, just let me hold your hand. So far it's the only way I can let myself be heard. 'Cause she thinks most people don't talk enough about how lucky they are. Most people don't know what it takes for me to get through the day. Most people don't talk enough about the love in their hearts. But she doesn't know most people feel that same way. She thinks most people don't talk enough about how lucky they are.
About how lucky they are.
Most people
don't know what it takes for me to get through the day.
Most people
don't talk enough about the love in their hearts.
Most people feel that same way.
The band Dawes live on Soundcheck here in our studio with the song Most People. Their new album is called Stories Don't End. You can catch them on July 24th at the Capitol Theater in Portchester, New York. Let's hear another song. We are going to hear Side Effects. It's Dawes live on Soundcheck.
If there was no word for love now, we'd see how strong it really is. We could find out what it looks like, or if it ever did exist. 'Cause every time you said you loved, seems like the point escaped us both. and the current interrupted. The moment that you spoke. Now there's a loophole in my theory that I cannot figure out. 'Cause if love was what they said it would be, then you'd be here with me. Perfected. It's how to laugh when you should cry. The side effects of broken promise becomes a way of getting by. So the next time that you see me and our exchange feels somehow cheap, know that I feel every word you're saying, but from just a few steps out of reach, where the view's a little hazy and the noise a little. Said it would be, then you'd be here with me now. If love was what they said it would be, then you'd be here with me now.
The band Dawes live on Soundcheck. I'm producer Greta Cohn. That was Tay Strathairn on piano and vocals, Griffin Goldsmith on vocals, Taylor Goldsmith on guitar and vocals. And we have two Goldsmiths in the room. And the harmonies that the two of you create are ones that I think siblings, you know, it sounds like siblings. I mean, have you been singing with each other since you were born?
Yeah, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Your dad was in kind of a funk band called Tower of Power, right?
Uh-huh.
So were you learning to sing the funk songs or other?
No,
other
he stuff? He's a songwriter. Mm-hmm. And he'd actually didn't ever even write for that band. But he has a catalog of his own materials. And growing up with those songs, there were certain ones that I favored and were easy enough for me to learn on piano. So,
can you remember a time when you weren't just all as a family making music? Or was that
it
just...
would always be like holidays or, you know, like a wedding or something. We would always end up, me, Griffin, and our dad would always end up on the stage by the piano, and we'd, you know, all sing together. It was always kind of those situations. Still happens all the time.
Well, it happens on your new album, Stories Don't End, and it will happen again on Wednesday, July 24th at the Capitol Theater in Porchester, New York. The name of the band is Dawes. They've been playing with us in the Soundcheck studio here today. And Taylor and the guys, thank you guys all so much for playing for us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
This is Soundcheck.
You found me on the other side of a loser's winning streak, where my thoughts all wander further than they should. Let me sing to you. Let me defend these hearts which are so rarely understood.
That's the song From the Right Angle by the band Dawes. Remember, you can listen to this session and our entire archive of live performances on demand at soundcheck.org. Throughout this week, we've been asking you to tell us about the first album you bought with your own money. And I want to thank everybody who called or tweeted or emailed. Here's a message that we got from Corinne.
The first record that I bought with my own money was back in 1958. I was 7 years old, and my 10-year-old sister and 12-year-old brother were going in on a deal for 3 45s for 25 cents and asked me to come in on it. And I picked out Come Softly to Me by the Fleetwoods. They made fun of me, but I stuck to my choice.
Come softly, darling. Come softly, darling. Come softly, darling. Come to me, stay. You're my obsession forever and a day.
Thanks for the call, Corinne. Here's another one from Marty in Queens.
Mine were actually two albums, Santana, Abraxas, and Led Zeppelin III.
Working from seven to 11. I don't think that's right.
Some people also tweeted us about their first album purchase. One of them was Pam, who writes, "First album I bought with my own money, Beauty and the Beat by the Go-Go's." Olivia tweeted, "The self-titled All-American Rejects. I don't miss being confusingly sad, angry, sad, but I do still love it." And Dee writes, "Chess Records boxed set. Gotta love Muddy Waters."
The gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, "You got a boy child coming. He gonna be a son of a gun. He gonna make pretty women jump and shout. Then the world wanna know what this all about, but you know I'm here." Everybody.
Up next, the surprising overlap between two very different bands and their fans. We'll talk with former AV Club head writer and Pitchfork staffer Nathan Rabin. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Here at Soundcheck, a lot of authors with a lot of books about bands come through the studio. Now, it's one thing to write a book about one polarizing band, say the jam band Phish or the carny rap outfit known as Insane Clown Posse. It's a complete other thing to write a book about both of those groups. The book is called You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me. Phish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. And I'm joined by the author of that book, Nathan Rabin. Nathan, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Insane Clown Posse and Phish, two of music's most maligned tribes, as you say in the subtitle of the book. What do they have in common? Why go after both groups?
That is a very good question, and one that I've kind of been rolling around in my mind for a very, very long time. And this actually started out as a book that was just going to be about Phish.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend at the time, now my wife, was kind of obsessed with them in high school and college. And I kind of pitched that to my agent, and he said, "I don't really know if there's a book just about Phish at this point. Why don't you make it a book about musical subcultures in general?" So I thought, that's really interesting. And when I thought about musical subcultures, I thought immediately about Insane Clown Posse, who I am obsessed with now. I was obsessed with them at that time as well. And this was right around the time that Insane Clown Posse released their video Miracles, which became kind of a viral sensation. It's mm-hmm. their message song about the glory of life and animals and nature.
Right.
That's also incredibly profane and has a number of seemingly nonsensical attacks on scientists and the concept of science in general.
Miracles each and everywhere you look, and nobody has to stay where they put. This world is yours for you to explore. It's nothing but miracles beyond your doors. The Dark Carnival is your invitation
to witness that without explanation.
Take a look at this fine creation
and enjoy it better with appreciation.
I think what they offer fans is this incredible sense of community. This idea that they're more than just a band, they're more than just an act, they're an entire community, they're an entire sort of ecosystem onto themselves. And when I was working on this book, I was feeling very kind of lonely, very isolated, very alienated. So that was incredibly appealing to me.
So you couldn't have picked two more disparate sounding bands or, you know, different divergent subcultures. But I guess your point is they're not just musical subcultures. There is more to it than that. And your story is not just the story of these two communities, as you put it, but it's the story of you as a writer going through some pretty tough times and finding things in each of these communities that gives you something that you need, it seems.
Oh, totally. It's the story of my mental unraveling. What was supposed to be sort of this, I wouldn't say dry sociological tome, but what was supposed to be kind of a pop sociological tome that was supposed to be a lot more kind of distant, a lot more kind of clinical, a lot less self-indulgent, became, you know, this sort of crazy story of my path through these, as you said, kind of seemingly disparate worlds that actually have a lot in common, one of which is I think they both offer this incredible sense of escape. Following ICP or following Phish is about as close as you can get in 2013 to running away to join the circus. And in 2011, the summer of 2011, when, you know, a lot of the book takes place, like that was incredibly appealing to me. You know, the concept of kind of running away from my life, which was pretty great in a lot of ways, but had become kind of a mess. And I became kind of overwhelmed by everything. In part because...
Well, in part because you had bipolar and hadn't been diagnosed yet. And that comes later on in the story, so...
Very much so, yeah. And that's the weird thing is I think... the thing about being bipolar is... you can get away with a lot of terrible judgment.
With all due respect to you, Nathan, both of these communities offered you many, many opportunities for bad judgment.
That's true. You know, and that's the thing is I kind of feel like I kind of have these two disparate sides of my personality. There is a kind of proper Midwestern gentleman who feels an appropriate sense of shame about everything. and then there's this kind of a space cadet adventurer side of me that wants to see and experience everything and doesn't really care what people feel about him. And I think those kind of two sides were kind of violently at war while I was working on this. And that somehow manifested itself in me having to write this book, but not doing any of the preparation, not doing any of the planning, not doing any of the kind of advanced research that was necessary to do so.
Well, let's talk about these two, subcultures one after the other. Let's start with Phish.
Sure.
We're speaking with Nathan Rabin. His new book is called You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Phish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Misaligned Tribes. Okay, so Phish, you said, you know, you didn't prepare for this. You just knew that your girlfriend was really into Phish, and that was enough to send you out on the road. Or was it?
Tell us who
Phish are and how that community works.
Sure. Phish, I guess kind of the sort of easy, glib shorthand would be to say that Phish is the world's premier jam band. And that for older gentlemen out there, they are kind of the contemporary equivalent of Grateful Dead.
Right.
And their music is characterized by a lot of improvisation, a lot of jamming, a lot of extended guitar solos. Sort of criticism that they engender, and it's, you know, more sort of glib dismissal, is that, you know, they're sort of caricatured as being hippies, being lazy, being drug-addled, being, you know, slackers, mm-hmm. contributing nothing to society. You know, and over the course of my travels, I found that to be very much not the case. I found their fan base to be incredibly eclectic. A lot of them are really, really smart, a lot of academics. There's something about, you know, sort of fish fandom that is kind of very conducive to being, you know, kind of a bit of a geek, a bit of an audiophile, to, you know, the sort of obsessive sort of fandom.
Are drugs an essential part of the fish fan experience?
Drugs, I'm not going to lie to you. Drugs are a big part of it, and it certainly was a big part of it for my experience. I think kind of one of the painful ironies, I don't even know if this qualifies as irony, I learned everything about irony from Alanis Morissette singles, is that Trey Anastasio is the lead singer and the guitarist for Fish, kind of the epicenter of this whole world. And he is a recovering alcoholic. He was arrested in 2004, I believe. It was a very bad scene with heroin. So he became a pretty, you know, public advocate for treatment rather than imprisonment for drug offenders.
Now, you write in the book that for you, one of the first songs to kind of catch your ear when experiencing Fish, which you do in the best way, which is to experience them live. They are very much a live band. Was with their cover of a Stevie Wonder song. Let's hear a little bit of Boogie On Reggae Woman from Fish.
I like to see you move right across the floor. I like to do it to you till you holler for more. I like to reggae, but you're much too fast for me. I like to make love to you. You can make me scream. So boogie on, reggae woman. What is wrong with you?
That is Fish covering a Stevie Wonder song, Boogie On, Reggae Woman, an old Stevie Wonder tune, from their album, which is winningly titled Hampton Comes Alive, recorded in Hampton, Virginia. Nathan Rabin's with me on Soundcheck. His book is called You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Fish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. Why don't people in the wider music community think they would like Fish fans or Insane Clown Posse fans?
Well, I think, you know, sort of the contempt that Fish fans engender, and I think, okay, contempt is a very, very strong word. I think people don't hate Fish fans. I think they dismiss them. Mm-hmm. And I think Fish fans are maligned because, you know, they're kind of caricatured as hippies.
What about Insane Clown Posse, though? Now, this is a very different community, very different way of presenting itself.
Oh, totally. And with them, I think part of the reason, part of it is a bit of a sales gimmick. Insane Clown Posse has long called itself the world's most hated band. I think a lot of the contempt that people have for juggalos, as their fans are called, is visceral in nature. Insane Clown Posse sprays its fans with Faygo soda.
Which is a regional soda.
And I think people think that's just disgusting. Like, why, for the love of God, would people want to be sprayed with soda while they're at a rock show? Like, that's just friggin' weird. Insane Clown Posse fans also wear clown makeup. I think people think that Insane Clown Posse fans look weird. They like weird things. They like music that a lot of people find really, really appalling. A lot of people find unlistenable. A lot of people find just a pox upon the musical scene.
Let's let our Soundcheck listeners decide for themselves, because this is some of that music from the band Insane Clown Posse, and a song called, at what little of it we can play on the radio, a song called Hocus Pocus. And I come with a hat full of trucks, trunk full of Faygo, car full of factions. You wicked clowns would like to sing what's up to the Cobras, X-Men, and cops, and everybody with clown love, even such I never heard of. Rolling in the town and out with the big top, four cards down and two more still to drop. And when it does, I pack up and hit the road, 'cause I don't wanna see your
your head explode. Talk me an axe and I'll toss you a dead chicken. At a bar, you get a 2 liter with him. And when he genie says I'm with the show, it's hocus pocus, jokers, great Malenko.
That's Insane Clown Posse from Detroit. The song is called Hocus Pocus. And that is the other of the musical subcultures, or maligned tribes, as he puts it, that Nathan Rabin spent some time among in the course of writing his book, You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me. How much of the difference between Insane Clown Posse fans, the Juggalos as they're known, how much of the difference between them and the Fishheads is one of education, class, you know, things like
money.
That?
A lot of it comes down to money. I think Fish fans, if I may generalize, which is exactly what this entire book is intended to get people not to do, Fish fans tend to be better educated, wealthier, of a higher social class. Whereas Insane Clown Posse fans, a big part of the reason why they're reviled is because they tend to be overwhelmingly poor. And because sort of Juggalo has become sort of cheap shorthand for white trash.
What did you find? What, you know, was that, you know, is that criticism? Is that stereotype unfounded?
I think a lot of Juggalos are inherently poor. But I think, you know, there's a lot of dignity to that poverty. You know, I think there's a lot of, and I also think there are a lot of Juggalos are more eclectic than people necessarily give them credit for. You know, there are some very smart people who really like Insane Clown Posse and who get something out of the culture and out of the experience. And yeah, I mean, I've loved visiting the Gathering of the Juggalos, which is their festival in Cavern Rock, Illinois, every year. Like, I've come to really, really embrace it. And there's freedom in this, freedom from judgment in particular, and freedom from self-consciousness.
Well, you know, on the other hand, Nathan, I mean, there are plenty of examples in your book of bad behavior on the part of Juggalos. And there is the famous incident at one of the gatherings. And you were there the night that Tila Tequila tried to perform her set and was, you know, the recipient of a lot of verbal abuse and some pretty nasty projectiles being hurled her way on stage, too. What did you make of that?
That night, things were just so weird and the vibe was so crazy. And I also had been hearing from all the Juggalos who I had been talking to that something was going to go down. And there was a sense that, you know, she had corrupted the values of the gathering. And she was this pop star. She represented all these tabloid values that they found abhorrent. Insane Clown Posse and Juggalo culture is very similar to the world of wrestling. And I think within the world of wrestling, there is a concept of a heel. The bad guy, the person that you boo, the person that you're supposed to root against so that the good guy will seem a lot better. And I think within the context of the Gathering of the Juggalos, Tila Tequila was the heel.
Although Nathan, as you say in the book, and as you've just told us, the vibe that night was already getting much, much darker and things took a really nasty turn. A performance at the Insane Clown Posse's annual Gathering of the Juggalos that went way off the rails. The whole story told in Nathan Rabin's book called You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Fish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. Is it your hope, Nathan, at the end of the day that they will be somewhat less maligned once we get a little bit of a view inside through your book?
I very much hope so. I mean, what I set out to do in this book was to humanize these subcultures, to put a face and a voice and a narrative and what I hope are, you know, pretty heartfelt.
And it has, for you, a happy ending because your girlfriend, then-girlfriend, Cadence, who is gone for a while, comes back. You guys are now married by the end of the book. It's a good story and one that works on a couple of levels. And Nathan Rabin, author, memoirist, thank you so much for sharing the story with us today on Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
I awoke, faintly bouncing round the room, the echo of whomever spoke. The place I sought was far beneath the surface of the sea. My sight was poor, but I was sure the sirens sang their song for me. They dance above me as I sing. I see them through a crystal haze and hear them bouncing round the room.
little more from Fish, one of the band's best-known songs, Bouncing Around the Room. That does it for the show today. On Monday, a live performance by Sarah Neufeld, best known as the violinist of the band Arcade Fire. She'll perform some of her solo music, and we'll begin a week-long series about the summer of 93. We'll look at the albums, the singles, the soundtracks, and the music news from that summer 20 years ago. Chris Melanfi will kick things off with a look at what was on the Billboard charts between May and September of 1993. And we'll want to hear from you. What were you doing in the summer of 93, and what were you listening to? Tell us, and we might use your story on the air. You can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612, or send us a tweet, or post a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. The number again, 866-939-1612. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team, with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop, with Alex Kappelman and our interns, Alex Martinez and Ian Petrarca. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. See you back here Monday. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.